Welcome to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN Community Radio, 88.5 FM on your radio dial.
In my heart, in my brain, on my tongue, behind my teeth. Behind my eyes, on my tongue, under my skin, in my heart. In my veins, under my skin, behind my teeth, on my tongue, on my tongue, on my tongue. You.
I'm Pamela Spoto, poet and host, along with Doug Bennett, engineer extraordinaire and producer, a man of many talents. We are broadcasting from the KKRN radio station in Round Mountain. This is Late Night Poetry Jam. We will be having a bi-monthly radio show the last Saturday of the month at 10 p.m. And today in the studio, we have Sarah McCurry. And she's a colleague of mine, a poet, musician, and friend, as well as a gardener, bread maker, and mother. And here she is. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Pamela. Thanks for having me.
This is great. And what we want to do on this Late Night Poetry Jam is also talk to the poets and artists about their lives. And I always find that really, really fascinating. And so we talked a little bit initially, and you said you were born in Whitefish, Montana.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
That's a great name. But then you didn't live there that long, right? Because you were moved to North Dakota. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. Yeah. Well, I was born in Whitefish, and that's where both my mother and father were from that area. And when I was about 4 and a half, they moved out to North Dakota to farm a family farm that was out there. And so actually that's where I spent most of my childhood and went to college as well. Got my bachelor's degree out in North Dakota too.
And we're going to be talking a little bit more about that because you're going to draw, I think, on that time period of living in North Dakota for some of your poetry called the Prairie Poems.
Right,
As I remember. And then you went to the State University, is that correct? And were you majoring in English at that time?
I was. I actually went around a little bit on that. I think between my freshman and sophomore years, I kind of bounced around between English major and music major and drama major and settled on English is probably the best way to keep a steady meal ticket for most of my life, which it's been.
So. Now, and from there, I'm a little confused whether you went to Alaska from there or to Texas from there, because you were at the State University, mm-hmm. and then you graduated. Did you get married at that point? You had a boyfriend.
I had a boyfriend, and he was a playwright and fiction writer at Minot State University. We were both attending Minot State University in North Dakota. And the day after graduation, we got married. We were 22, and all of our family was in town, and so we thought that would be handy. So we got married and put all of our worldly possessions in a Geo Metro, with our cat. And headed out to Alaska, and camped all the way up. And he was going to school up there, and in Anchorage. And so we lived up there for about 9 months, and then he actually got into school down in Texas. And so then we moved back down and to the States, into the lower 48, and went to Austin, Texas.
And didn't you say your husband at that time was a fiction writer? He was also writing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He was a fiction writer. He was very talented and then also a playwright. And so one of the reasons we ended up moving down to Austin was because he got a James Michener Fellowship. And so we actually to UT Austin. And so we actually got to meet James Michener. And he was just a lovely person with sort of a lovely kind of understated home. And I think he got a kick out of us because we were a couple of raw kids from the prairie, you know. And so we were I think, a lot less refined than many of the folks who, I suppose, kind of courted his attention in those days.
And I think, and we've talked a little bit about that, and we'll probably talk more about it as we go on, but there's a real freshness with that, you know, when you talk about, we're from the prairie. We're off the prairie, and we don't have we haven't developed, I don't know whether it's developed or integrated certain kinds of, I don't know what I would call them, a different way of being, whether they're masks in a way or not.
Urbanity was kind of out of our reach, really. You know, it wasn't an option for us. We were small town kids.
And when you were in Alaska, I believe you mentioned that you substitute taught during the day, mm-hmm. and then at night you telemarketed.
I did. It was a 1-2 punch. It was a 1-2 punch, and it was kind of an interesting time because, you know, you're this age where you're very excited and you're out on your own, and you know, you've got your degree in hand, and you find yourself substitute teaching during the day. I had some great adventures up there though, and I loved substitute teaching. And then I telemarketed the Anchorage Daily News at night, cold calls. What you'll do for money. And my boss was a wonderful fellow named Ed Thigpen. And Mr. Thigpen did karaoke at a Chinese restaurant. And so we'd all go out and listen to Ed do karaoke. And he was a dead ringer for Lionel Richie. So those were good times in kind of a weird way. I mean, if enough alcohol was involved, which it usually was. So that was helpful.
And then, so you were there for about 9 months, and mm-hmm. then you went to Texas State to work on your MFA.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And so can you tell us a little bit about the MFA program for writers-to-be and also for people that might want to go into an MFA program? And also, this was the time when you were drawing on your experiences of living on the prairie, and you have wonderful stories about, and I don't even know if I should maybe bring this up right now,
sure.
But as a kid, I mean, didn't you have a pony on the prairie, and you'd ride the pony around, and you had a big dump heap out
yes.
in the area, and you'd ride your pony out there, and then you would burn, or somebody or family would burn the garbage, and you would watch aerosol cans blow up.
Yeah. I've got a poem about it that I will actually read. And so many of the things that I was writing in those years, the first few years of moving off of the plains were about the plains, you know, and just the experiences I had there growing up and my family. And so those things sort of worked themselves out in various ways, in memory and kind of longing, I guess, for that landscape in the first few years after I left it. And going into an MFA program, I was very excited about it. And I thought, well, this kind of validates my writing in a way. And I think that's kind of a dangerous thing to think. You know, there are a lot of MFA programs out there, and it's a great place to be if you want to be with a whole bunch of people who are reading and talking about poetry, who are loving it, and who are writing poetry. You know, and so I think that could be really useful. But I think the danger of it is you know, the one that I think gets cited a lot. And this is, you know, I mean, my experience is, I guess, you know, 15 years stale now, but I can't assume it's changed that much. You know, you get, you start sounding like other people. You start sounding like the other people who are in your poetry workshops, or perhaps kind of the dominant figure in that poetry workshop. You start sounding like the favorite, you know, unless you have, I think, a very, very big sense of your own self as a young person, particularly if you go in then, you start sounding like the favorite poets of the people who run your workshops.
Exactly.
And I think there's a real difficulty. And now looking back on my early work, wow, can I see the difference? You know, there was a certain, I mean, there's a rawness and a freshness and there's more of a guardedness in that MFA work. There's more of a sense of self-awareness that's not really useful to the poem. self-consciousness, I guess I'd call it. Yeah.
So I want to, talk just a little bit more about your life, and then you're going to start reading poetry. After you got your degree in Texas, then you and your husband moved to Eugene, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear it's a wonderful place. I mean,
yes.
I passed through Eugene. I've spent a few days there, but there's lots going on. And I think one of the most interesting, well, before I get to that point, I think you said you stopped writing while you were in Eugene. Were you playing music at that time too?
Yeah, as I was finishing my thesis in Austin, I started playing the penny whistle, and that's kind of a long story in itself. But I am Scots-Irish, you know, in background, and I started picking up the penny whistle, which is a traditional Irish instrument. And when we moved to Eugene, I started playing at a local session, and I found myself playing more music and not writing poetry, and then being involved in the PhD program in Eugene. So my doctoral work in English. So I found that music sort of took the place of poetry there.
And if it's okay, this is more on a personal note.
Sure, that's fine.
I thought it was really, to me, it's kind of fascinating that, so you and your husband moved to Eugene, and then you divorced your husband in Eugene, and then you got married in Eugene.
Yes, I did. I did. My first wedding ring is somewhere in the McKenzie River. So, you know, which is probably, I think that's a respectful place to put it, you know? We had grown apart in various ways, as you know, the old saw goes, and it just seemed like the best way to go. And so I started after the divorce, I started playing with a local Irish band, and kind of a punk Irish band. We did Flogging Molly and Pogues covers and originals. And that's how I met my now husband, my husband, Sean McEwen, who is the love of my life. And he was our mandolin player. And the first time I played music with him, I was giving the drummer a ride home because I was basically the only person with a car. It was still a Metro. And I told our drummer, I said, I don't know if I'm going to like playing with this guy. He's got such a big personality. And we've been married for years now.
So, in terms of your divorce, you tossed your wedding ring into the river,
and then drank some whiskey because there was just a lot of that.
And you burned your dissertation, is that correct?
We did, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, my it was a ritual. You know, everybody's got their rituals, and my advisor at the University of Oregon, who was a fabulous, amazing person. But she told me once, she said, you know, you're deeply ambivalent about academia. And that really stuck with me as kind of one of the best compliments I've ever gotten, you know. And I was. And so when I was finished, I felt like I had something that in some ways was really valuable to me as close reading of some of my favorite poets. But as an academic product, it wasn't really me, you know. It was this strange hybrid creature of what I had to produce under certain pressures and with certain strictures on my writing style and subject matter. So I gathered around with some of my old bandmates when I defended the dissertation, after I defended it, and we took a big copy of it and put kerosene on it and lit it up and drank some more whiskey. we don't do that anymore. We're old now. But well, that's what we did, and it was great. It was very therapeutic, actually.
Good for you. And then just quickly, because we're going to start reading, and you're going to start reading, and I'm going to read a few things as we go on. But so from Eugene, Oregon, you moved to San Diego, and you taught at the Art Institute. Is that correct?
That's correct.
In San Diego. And then eventually you came to Reading and to Shasta College, and we're so lucky and we're so glad that you're here.
Well, I love it.
And so that brings us to some poetry. And so I'm really wanting to hear some of your prairie poems. And I know that you're going to be reading some, and you may be playing guitar with some. It just depends,
I think, on
how you feel at the moment. And so in this prairie poem section, I think you have the prairie poems, and also, and this involves nature and the inability to connect with nature, and also family is a part of that. So why don't you go ahead, and if you want to say anything about the poems, go ahead, or let them stand as they are.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, this one kind of, I think, sums up sums up some of the experience of growing up as a really little kid on the prairie. It's very short, but it's about going pheasant hunting with my father when I was little, and it's called The North Quarter, 1980. Sometimes, even now, waking in the night, trailing hunters through the odor of fall burdock, so happy, the wrung necks of four pheasants still warm and heavy in my hands.
Oh. That's the first time I've heard burdock in a poem. I love it. I love it.
Okay. It came up a lot, actually. You know, there was a lot of it to see. So it came up a lot in those early poems. This one is called Anticipation, and we had a little garbage dump. We didn't take it to the county or anything, and then we would burn. I know it's perhaps the most environmentally friendly practice, but do remember that this was, you know, the 80s in North Dakota. So Anticipation. The cold wind leaves word of newspaper ash and choke cherry blossom, then turns north to sweep clean runnels through the chaff of last year's harvest. Spring. In the pasture, I burn the family dump, an acrid pile of our winter refuse tucked in the muddy, bulldozed cleft of a balding hill. Wall-eyed cows gather solemnly around me to watch the fire like the faithful snake hypnotized at a Sunday revival. I sit upslope and upwind as I am able, squatting with clumsy haunches tucked tight against the slick spring mud, waiting for aerosol cans to explode.
And what was your pony's name that you rode out there on?
My pony's name was Magria. My uncle told me that it was Spanish for gray, which it's not, to my knowledge, but... But anyway, if somebody can fill me in on that, I would appreciate it. But she was a little brown round Shetland pony, and she liked to try and scrape you off against wooden fences. And she was my best buddy.
I think uncles do that.
Anyway, it was a cool name, you know.
Yeah.
So Anticipation, the poem I just read, I was probably 16, maybe 15 or 16 when that occurred. And then this next poem is about the little town. I lived 8 miles outside of a town of 1,000 people. And this poem is about the little town that I went to school in called Washburn, North Dakota. It was on the Lewis and Clark Trail and close to the original site of Fort Mandan, which was where Lewis and Clark spent the winter with the Mandan people. And what's interesting about this poem is it never made it into an MFA manuscript, and I thought it was not worthy of anything. And I went back and I read it, and I thought, well, I kind of like this, you know? And it's about something called the Snake Dance. We'd have a big Riverboat Days festival in the summer in Washburn. And we'd all get together and form a big chain. Maybe they do this all over the place, I don't know. But we all the people in the town would get together and form a long chain, and then they'd run through the town like crazy. Even the bars, which was quite exciting for all of us who were not of age. And so I thought, well, this is kind of a weird sort of a heathen sort of an experience, you know, for a little Lutheran town. So I wrote this poem about it. Snake Dance. We meet in the parking lot at the high school, all tennis shoes and hairspray and anticipation. We are all shapes and ages, here to perform a ritual of sorts for Riverboat Days, the celebration of our muddy, snag-filled river. We form a single line, hold hands with siblings, parents, lovers, or whomever. It doesn't matter, because we're linked, just for right now, just this once a year. The man in front runs marathons, and as we start, we can tell we're him. He's the thought to this body, and we'll angle fast, first down the crumbled sidewalk that smells of notebook and gum and deodorant, and then down the hill towards Main Street, tonight replete with carnival cotton candy, beer and smoke and sweat from anticipation that this summer something will happen. Tonight something will happen, maybe, in Washburn, North Dakota, that will be questioned and answered in coffee shops and in hunting blinds down all the years that will inevitably pass here. But it doesn't matter now, because we're linked and running as fast as an athlete, whipping around the rides and then through the bars as people look up from their drinks and shout smiles at us, and our hands begin to ache, but we hold the snake in our hands, writhing, and we worship it and hold the river's undertow within us. Sorry. I'm a big weeper. Pamela knows this. Anyway.
I forgot. Now I remember.
I'm so excited. Okay. And we worship it and hold the river's undertow within us, linked just this once a year. And the darkness yields to let us go wherever we want. Sweat dripping from faces and hands slipping into other hands and bodies moving inexorably into the spaces of the next body, like rings of muscle, like a snake swallowing a rat, unhinging its jaws, its maw eating the world like an egg, and it passes through all of us, even the little kids who shiver with the blood iron taste, until we stop and fall apart, and the whole town is whole now for another year because of us.
That is a wonderfully powerful poem, and you know what? How you prefaced it with it never made it into
into my MFA manuscript. I didn't even bring it into a workshop because I was afraid of the response it would be getting. Obviously, it moves me. so many things do.
It moves me too because it has this very powerful energy.
And I can
feel it. I can see it, and I can feel it, and those muscles and bumping in and on, you know, other people. And the idea of being linked, you know, linked for now, and this marathon man is leading.
I know.
Woof. And it is a ritual that allows the town to live for another year. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Thank you. Thanks.
So what do you have for us next?
Well, let's see. I think I just have a couple of other poems in this section. This one's called Home Video. So my brother and I went to Minot State University, and I guess in my second year there, my parents had kind of had it with the prairie. They were kind of mountain folk. They were done. They were ready to go home. And so they actually moved back to Montana. Again, up above Whitefish, Montana is where kind of all of our family is from. So they moved back, and our farm, the land was, as with so many farms in the Midwest, the land was rented out to a neighbor, and the house itself, which was always kind of a thrown up affair, you know, it sort of dissolved, and so did my family's gardens, and so that was kind of interesting. And then when we would come back to see the farm, it was a strange experience. And so this poem is called Home Video, and it's about I don't remember when this would have been, but when my mom and dad and brother went back and saw the farm several years after they had left, and it had kind of fallen into disrepair. And I wasn't there for this. I watched the home video at home, my own, which I think was then in Austin. Home video. Silver paint flakes to sharp rust on the abandoned clothesline. My brother pans the camcorder across the backyard to the house, still all odd angles. Windows and doors boarded over, deaf and dumb to the scab red paint soaked into its board and batten, sun and grit fading it to a half-healed abrasion. "Here's the house," he says. Neither he present there with my parents, nor I stretched in front of my TV, believe it. Our doubt swallows the silence after his voice. The barn, then, still the same gray hulk, and at the pump house door, daylilies still hiss violent orange epithets into the encroaching weeds. But the teeming garden is a ghost, is gone, and the plum trees a dead mesh of thorn. Corrals are choked in twining pigweed, stalks thick as baby's wrist, harsh as steel wool. Now my brother cuts to the wheat field above the farm, where a low spring sky threatens the defining windbreaks, where wind snakes through the chaff, mouths sibilance into the microphone. And here our parents walk towards the field's highest rise. My brother's eye follows them, holds them firmly centered in my screen, then magnifies their strange, soft masks of crucial and familiar sorrow. The land advances quietly. All of us feel it, but no lone voice can support our questions.
That's a beautiful poem.
Thank you. Thanks.
I mean, how things change, how time changes that which is around us. I could just, it's a very visual poem. You know, your last poem about the snake dance, I mean, I one of the reasons I like that is just it was so high energy. I could just feel it. And then this poem, the images, I mean, they're right there in my mind's eyes. It's very beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. And I just have one more from the Plains poems, I think. It's called Impartial Justification. Late summer, when the Russian thistles are tassel-blown and weary and heat ghosts off the prairie. Limbo season, little to think of beyond small tasks. The table polished and smelling of lemon, the garden watered in early morning, and the last flowers arranged in waiting. No one tells us how to inhabit this body. It's a skill we learn in narrow, sporadic flashes, light throwing its small comfort under the door of the dark room. The smell of cigarette and summer passing, the sound of the meadowlark singing, desire of my heart. These things that slowly inform themselves, inform us of delight and melancholy, of delight.
You are listening to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN Community Radio, and Sarah McCurry is our featured, I was going to say favorite, well, maybe favorite and featured for tonight, poet and musician in the studio, and as well as Doug Bennett, of course, our engineer and producer. And we've been talking about prairie poems and listening to prairie poems and some wonderful, wonderful poetry. And I'm going to read a poem now because it has to do with nature and it fits into this nature feeling and connecting with nature and being on the prairie, except it's not about the prairie, but it is connecting to nature. And then Sarah will continue with several family poems of that same time sequence. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And this poem is called Names of Things. And there's a philosophy behind this, I think, that if we know the names of things, whether they're flowers, plants, people, whatever species they are, that we would be less likely to kill those things when we know them by name instead of, oh, that over there, or the enemy, or whatever, the weed. We know the names of things, and there's a kind of respect for the web of life. And so that is what this poem is about. So here I go. I want to know the names of things. When I know the names of things, I can stop and really see. I can name the burdock, red sorrel, calendula, when I know the names of things. I know the sugar pine, ponderosa, Pacific yew. I know the Zulu prince, white sage, Mexican sunflower. When I know the names of things, I have a relationship. I am connected to the other. When I know the names of things, I see the beauty in the golden eagle, black vulture, red-shouldered hawk. I see the seal bay llama and the black Arabian stallion. When I know the names of things, I see amaranth pull and dance toward the sun. I see mighty ashwagandha and holy basil bloom. I see the sphinx moth kiss evening primrose. And I am drawn into this life force, this chi of things. I wonder why. Why would I want to bomb all this? Use earth-penetrating weapons on it? Plant landmines in rich, fertile soils or ancient desert sands? Poison cold, delicious waters? Cut and burn the huge old trees? Fill the sky with air? I cannot breathe. I cannot breathe. When I know the names of things, let me call you by your name, not us and them. When I truly know your name, we become I and thou. Let me call you by your name. Khalid, Carlos, Amal, Che, Tua, Hugo, Jim, Felipe, Tala, Musa, Little Dog, Melita, Moro, Kuzuko, Kalen, Cam, Fast Horse, Doug, Arij, Muna, Loreen, Akichita, Ahmed, Khalid, Carlos, Tua, Felipe, Moro, Cam, Fast Horse, Akichita, Akichita. May we learn the names of things. May we find the I and thou. May we feel the mountain's sweet embrace and the wind's enchanting songs. Let us kiss, kiss our lovers, kiss our lovers well, and love this Mother Earth and all the blessings she provides.
Oh, I love that one. I heard you read that at the sustainability conference at Shasta College a few years back, and was kind of blown away. And I think you had some percussion accompaniment.
Yes, in fact, it was my partner who was playing drums, and he was chanting a Lakota sacred song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Talk about tearing up. That whole thing makes me tear up when we really, yeah. I think, I don't know what it is, when we really feel connected, mm-hmm. you know, to the web of life, and then there's the possibility of it just being poisoned or killed.
You know,
or
Derek Jensen speaks to that, and he said that, you know, he was weepy all the time, and he felt that loss all the time, and somebody told him, you should. You should. This should be something that you feel deeply and that moves you and that you mourn, you know? So it's I mean, that poem asks the fundamental question, doesn't it? You know, why would we want to do any of this? Why would we want to destroy?
And as
we could be in relationship with.
And as we destroy that, I mean, it seems to me people don't realize we're destroying ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's that disconnection.
Right.
That somehow I can destroy this out there, but it doesn't affect me. And
I don't mean to laugh, but I mean, it's
yes,
you know,
yes,
it's pretty amazing,
yes.
that we have that disconnect still.
Yeah. So, Sarah, you're going to read several more poems about family.
Yeah, I'll read a couple about my family. And again, these are from sort of my early work, I guess. So sort of the same time frame as the rest of the Prairie poems. Let me see. This one is about honeycomb, and it's titled Honeycomb. Orange blossoms make the best honey. When the creek water was sweetening from the heavy heat of August, Uncle Harold brought us honeycomb in mason jars, rare webbed crystals suspended in viscous sun. We gathered around the table. Harold scooped the honey and comb into china bowls and doled them out, a communion made sweeter because it was not from our own hands. Everyone smiled and licked their spoons. In each folktale, the heroine has a magic talisman, a copper bee, an ivory flower, a talking willow, which serves to guide her through the underworld, or an ogre's trickery, or the vague presumptions of her own heart. Let my talisman be a quart-jarred honeycomb, the amber symbol of what another's gift of love and work might bring.
Ooh.
Another one that never made it to an MFA workshop. I didn't even remember writing that.
That is so wonderful, though, because I can see that honeycomb and the honey in that bowl, and
you're all
partaking of that. And you're right; it's from another's work,
right,
that
right.
we get that gift.
Yeah, it's not about, you know, it's not about a transcendent moment of not connecting, which was what was kind of in vogue when I was in workshop. About not connecting with stuff. That was what I took from my master's work, unfortunately. But this one's called Music Night at the Sunflower Cafe. My father is a folk musician. And plays Irish music and folk music, and he's a tremendous singer. I come from a family of absolutely stellar singers, and my voice is passable. So I spent a lot of time growing up listening to him. And they used to play music at a place called the Sunflower Cafe in Eureka, Montana. Music night at the Sunflower Cafe. Sitting there in the river of it, an Irish reel, part tongue-in-cheek, part mourning, a feeling that we've been let loose to make what sweet music we can in the interims left us, left dead broke and busting here for air. Sitting there with the room washing over me, the give of the music, the comfort it wants to burden me with, coming so close to flowering into the prodigal daughter in my corner of the Sunflower Cafe, to surrendering into the traveler far from home. But transcendence doesn't want us forever, or for even more than a hopeful breath. Till the river I'm washed in flows back to its source, till it's no more Shirley's fiddle, no more Dad's light, wary tenor, and the tears of understanding. No moment, no moment at all.
Some of the names are so cool, of towns and of cafes and the Sunflower Cafe.
Yeah, it was a beautiful place. I had the best Italian bread, and it was run by friends of the family, and also some musicians in that lot. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful place. And it's been out of business for many years now, but it was a great place for people to meet and for ideas and music. Just a fabulous place. Good cinnamon rolls, too.
Ooh, yum.
This one I'm just going to call Cousin because it's actually titled after the name of the cousin in the poem. and this cousin, unfortunately, is afflicted by schizophrenia. And watched the movie Fried Green Tomatoes, In which the bad guy gets barbecued by some townsfolk at the end. And somehow that's okay in the movie because he's a bad guy, right? Which is a little strange. But she watched the movie and she decided that she better not come to the family reunion because she was a little afraid we were going to barbecue her. So this is a poem about that. You know, I got to thinking about that for a minute. So, cousin, you won't come to the family reunion because you watched a movie where a man was barbecued. Big fat black pot, small shreds of meat caught between greedy teeth. He was eaten out of existence. And you figured we'd do that to you. We would have, it's true. There would be those two blank bright grins, asking mildly how you'd been while you were away. As if away were a state of mind. As if somewhere there existed a place beyond the gravid apple orchard, the clean new crop of cousins, or the trout pond full of sibilant shadows sliding to its moss-slick banks, from which small children are always called away, but where you know you must have drowned one white summer day, too heavy to swim through.
That's a pretty amazing line. Eaten out of existence.
Yeah. Now, that one's kind of a weird one, you know. I mean, I think it's pushed in two different directions that I think never the twain shall meet. You know, there's a moment of humor that dovetails into something pretty, you know, pretty serious. But you know, sometimes I guess we're struck by the juxtaposition of that. So, and I was, yeah.
So before we move into our rebound relationship section, was there anything else that you wanted to read from your prairie poem section?
You know, I think that's about it. I think
maybe we should talk about rebound relationships and what that means. And I pulled out an old poetry manuscript, and it's kind of interesting because something that we talked about this morning, my good friend Doug hadn't heard before, and I think a lot of people haven't heard these poems from 15 years ago or so. And when I found these the other day, I mean, I'm cleaning up the study, and I went, oh my goodness, what is this? And it's this poetry manuscript, and it's pretty bleak. Looking back on it, and at the time, it was chronicling what, you know, my relationship MO, and I have a, well, I guess I should admit, I have a counselor, and he's wonderful because anything I say, he goes, oh, that is such a good opportunity.
We all should have a counselor. We all should.
And he's
maybe a team.
And he's wonderful because, I mean, part of the idea is, I guess, that we go through what we go through in order to get to where we are today. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a wonderful relationship today, mm-hmm. That is really, and you said your husband is a fabulous man, and yet in the past, and it's not that everybody has had bad relationships, but I mean I certainly have had my share of them, cold comfort bad relationships. And I was reading, and I mentioned this to you this morning, a poem to my current partner, and he goes, oh my goodness, don't read that, you know. And the first line is, I woke up dead. And mm-hmm. And but I was just trying to get the feeling that a lot of people go through when we say, you know, at the end at a divorce or the end of a marriage, or we have a great loss and we feel like we're coming apart. And what is that feeling? Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. is what that poem is about. And so some of these poems is kind of chronicles the beginning and the end of relationships. So that's kind of my these are old poems that I'm going to read a few at some point. So. What about you, Sarah?
Wow. Well, you know, if we have time, I'd sort of like to take a couple from my first marriage.
Oh,
my first marriage, and they may explain why that didn't last. I'm not sure. and then go into the rebound relationship, and isn't that fun? This one's called Your Own Mother, and I wrote this. It's brief, but you know, when you get into your mid-20s and you have a spouse who refers to you as the wife, as in, I'll come out if I can get away from the wife. You start thinking about that. And of course, you also do kind of grow up into your parents' habits and I guess ways of being in so many ways. And so I was kind of working with that at the same time. So this is called Your Own Mother. I breathe in my mother's low voice. Her patterns have become my patterns. Today's anniversary is crystal. I watch you wearing my mother's smile. Tonight we will dance in the kitchen as you, unaware, accept my mother's kisses.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. And this one is called For My Husband Reading the Journals of Christopher Columbus. And I actually still like this poem a lot. You know, my first husband was reading the journals of Christopher Columbus, and I couldn't really figure out why. And there was a lot of space between us at that point, but I think that some of that space is really necessary in a relationship. You need your own space. And so this is kind of about that. For my husband, reading the journals of Christopher Columbus. After you leave, it rests closed, quiet on the coffee table. The map under its plastic-bound cover tracing red and blue veins against a background the thin tan of vellum. Latitude, longitude, azimuth, zenith, I think. The sweet salt taste of earth by ocean. I don't know what leads you to a life unlike your own, to a man whose aspirations wove a net that winnowed dreams and nightmares, wove knots too complicated to untie into the relief of our pure applause or condemnation. What I know is that you haven't mentioned it. You go there for your own purposes, turn pages in your own time and after your own fashion. Unlike Bluebeard's wife, who had some closets of her own, I have no intention of opening even a door as thin as paper. Some countries are our necessary own, without which we are mirrors, static, each reflection buoying up the other endlessly. What territories we discover are new, to be explored together, separately, with compass, passion, compassion.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it didn't work out that way, but it's a nice thought, anyway. do you want me to go on to the rebound relationship poems now, or would you like to read a few of the relationship poems, and I'll come back to a couple of mine?
Well, maybe that's a good idea. And I probably have, and we talked a little bit about this, 8 or 9 or 10 poems, but some of them are so short. They're
mine
like,
too.
like 10 second poems.
You're busy so, in a rebound relationship.
So maybe I'll read 2 or 3 and then you can read some and I'll read some. And,
okay.
And I think Cupid, this notion of Cupid playing a large part in my relationship, I kept thinking Cupid was like aiming his arrow at me and not at the other person, and I didn't think that was fair. So this one is, Cupid took a big, delicious bite out of me. I swooned and swooned, but never fell exactly. I caught myself and moved. Mouth watering after you. That was a mistake. And this one, hot eyes, Indian nose, teeth I'd like to lick. You paint tomatoes, bell peppers, summer squash over white rice like you paint the sun red and moon yellow. It's Saturday, and I'm still stunned by you. I think I have this fantasy of who this person is. That was part of my problem. I'm different now. let me see. What did I do? Oh, this is an intimacy poem. I think at that time, this is what I thought. This is intimacy. It's called August 19th. It's a nursery rhyme. I slit myself open, cut out my heart, and slice it in two. Holding the pieces, I show them to you. I'm wide open. Take what you need. I give you intimacy.
Oh, I love the sense of rhythm in your work. Love it.
Oh, well, thank you. And I'll read this one, and then I'll turn it back over to you. This is called Sunday. I like riding in your truck, the way it moves when you shift. And seatbelt free, I like sitting next to you, really close, looking at your face, how your lashes touch. From the dash, Sunday passion hangs on chains in the back. The rope and pitchfork tangle. Okay.
Oh.
Old poems.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I have one more that is, I guess, around the time of the dissolution of my first marriage. And when, you know, things are bad there for a while. And and it just seems like the world gives you little hints of what could be good and what could be bad. But I think you have to be careful of looking for metaphors in everything that occurs around you during that time. There's a I don't know. I'm pretty down with magical thinking, actually. But, you know, I think there's a lot of magical thinking of all types that goes on in that period of time. This one's called rather grandiosely Ruin. Your pain is no metaphor for mine. Delicate, tiny hands quiet under your head. Possum baby drooping underneath spring's slick branch. One eye dangling, a bloody, surreal loop. No metaphor. Still, I've seen you now. Can't pretend I haven't. I go inside for a box to put you in. When I return, you're gone. Little ambassador from the court of night. Yeah.
I'm still absorbing that image.
Yeah.
It reminded me. No, never mind.
Oh. Let's see. And these are some rebound poems, you know, that first excitement of someone new after years with the same person, you know, and finding that somebody actually may, lo and behold, find you attractive again. It's a wonder. It's a wonder, folks.
yes.
This one is called As Bloom, and I guess it's subtitled The Market, June 10th. There were a lot of there were a lot of farmers market sort of meetings in the early days of this relationship. A lot of chance farmers market meetings, perhaps too many for chance. Peonies are never bitter lovers. Snow globed, they rest rain heavy, cupped against the silence of my palms. Oh, keep these hands steadfast as white blossoms. Let me send roots down underneath your bright gaze. Let me suffer love until this rain releases suffering, till I raise my eyes for that touch, frail as bloom and no wiser. That's you know, no wiser is about right. let's see, just a couple more from this. This one is called, again, rather grandly, I think. I mean, rethink this. Enamorata. When I was a child, the world loved itself in me, another still presence among sun-filled stalks of prairie grasses, silent enamorata of the coneflowers. I could disappear in the coyote's pale cry, cattail fingerlings hidden underwater, thousand-scented, matchless summer storms. Open, resonant as a touch, I learned reception is never a lesson. The taste of the small of your back is like that, and the far edge of drowning inside your salt damp hair. Let's see, this one's called Morning. An ice cream truck dopplers by your front door. In the kitchen window frame, a backyard hydrangea tilts up shy blue mouths to be kissed. Who knows what time it is? One more. And this one's called Little Rain. I had a friend and colleague at the university who was from South Korea, Jin Young Kim. And this is a poem about him. He knew I worked at a garden center and loved gardening. Little Rain. Junyeon tells me passionate gardeners always lose their lovers. What offering of flesh is sure, perfect as a lush, unthinking bloom? Too much or too little rain might break my heart today, but such pain is a calm encircled by the names my tongue must learn to love more than your skin. Daphne Adora, Lithodora Diffusa, Dicentra, the bleeding heart. I don't know, my heartbeat's shadow, if this desire is word or bloom or bruise.
This is Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN. I'm Pamela Spoto, here in the radio studio with Sarah McCurry and, of course, Doug Bennett, the man engineer and other things, producer. And we are in the section of reading poems on a relationship and rebounds, and these are old, for me, they're old poems, and I think some of these for Sarah mm-hmm. are some old poems as well. And I may finish with one new poem at some point. That would be good. So this is called December 20th. You perch on the edge of the abyss, slightly off balance. You would have me believe you are desperate, panicked, precariously perched. I don't believe you. You like the view. It's called Coyote. She draws a bead, sheer fear, you move, she pursues, sets her sights, a capable huntress. She knows you are illusion. My boots slip in the snow. On the ridge, I follow snow prints moving through manzanita and pine. I stop, struck by sheer white, from tall, slim pines on a higher ridge. A bird calls, notes tumble to me. I climb silk sounds through cold space, cut clean to you. And then it's over. Up and gone, just like that, before I knew it, you were gone. I didn't know how much of you was me. Where'd I go? You were never, never here. And I'm going to read a poem that's called It's my one country western poem. It's I've been loving the wrong right man. I'm leaving with the same passion I came with. I'm leaving because I ain't no fool, just dumbstruck, dazzled in love. I'm leaving your hot hazel eyes and your mouth wet from kissing me in my fantasy. And then part of the problem was letting go was really hard. I'm a Scorpio. I'm a double Scorpio. I have the grip, the bite, I think, of the pit bull. And so this is called Instead of Letting Go. Instead of letting go, I decided to be a shaman, get some shaman shoes, go down earth tunnel and snag you. Instead of letting go, I decided to be a shaman, get some shaman shoes, eat some grub, shake some rattles, drink boiled green tobacco leaves, and appear in your fantasies. Instead of letting go, I decided to be a shaman, get some shaman shoes, snare 5,896 spirit helpers. I need them all to tell you gently, I am the one, and to call. And the last poem, I really like writing poems about plumbers, and I had a plumber out recently, but this is not about him. But this is a true conversation with a man of the trades, and this was when I was living in Chico, and the toilet tank was leaking. And so this is the poem. I called the plumber today. I told him the toilet tank was leaking into the bowl, a very small leak. And the float was old, and a plastic tube was slipping. He said, sounds like you need a whole new ball and cock. I sighed and agreed. So that's the last poem of my section. So, Sarah, what do you have for us?
Wow. Well, that's a hard act to follow, Pamela. Not to make a clumsy transition, but I'm a mother now.
Well,
and that means and things. Obviously that has changed a lot of things for me. And so I guess I'd like to finish up with just a couple of poems. And one was I was an older mother. I was put in a category, as we so often are, of being an older mother. When I got pregnant, I was, I guess, 35. And and took a little while to get pregnant with Ellie Pearl, my daughter. And this is a poem that I wrote actually probably when I was about 5 days pregnant, didn't know it yet. But I woke up from a nap, jumped out of bed, and wrote this poem, which I still find kind of interesting. And I titled it Pishog, which is Gaelic, and it means kind of a little charm. My seal, my little wriggler, the warm womb I've kept for you grows cold in years, and everything I turn my hand to blossoms but you. Seeds stuck in the pod, fern curled tight, tiny velvet dot on the fur of night. There's no amount of coaxing that will do. I never asked to be a shell, a house, a vase for the sun to fill. It was what I was born into. So, when I call for you, littlest one, tiny thumb of thought and dream, come home.
Those have lovely images. See, that's the
thank
thing
you.
About Larry Harris and about you, is I wonder, I think, where do those images come from? They're gorgeous.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks. And then just, I have one more mother poem. I'm kind of too busy to being a mother right now to write too many poems about it, but I'd love to write more. Ellie loves and has loved since you know, she's been alive, kind of, the fairy book story of Thumbelina. And of course, Thumbelina is, you know, tiny and has adventures. But what I find interesting as a mother is, of course, her mother gets left behind. And you hear no more of her, and Thumbelina, you know, heads off and has adventures and ends up in this wonderful life elsewhere.
not to insert myself into the picture, but so I was fascinated by the idea of the mother and Thumbelina. So this is called Thumbelina. Little treasure, little miracle of wishes and barley corn. The woman told me love would bring you. Perfect hands, light as hummingbirds, waving mother. Then a morning and your tiny bed cold, covers strewn and the window cracked like a toad's mouth. I, who waited, who wished so long, who loved each line and feature, am not part of the story. Left at the beginning of things, I will not see you lifted up and carried to the warm lands, where someone else will love you. Someone else will give you those wings.
You have been listening to Late Night Poetry Jam with our featured poet, Sarah McCurry, who also teaches at Shasta College. I am Pamela Spoto, the host of Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN.